This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
You know, in theory, you look at that and you say, okay, if we're going to have to get to 50% renewables either way, it should be cheaper to do it in such a way where we're getting the, you know, the cheapest renewables we can, you know, on the system to serve people in California.
What do you think of when you hear the word billionaires? Ruthless capitalists? Decadent narcissists? Evil cheese puffs? What about renewable power? Well, today on Sea Change Radio, we hear from Sammy Roth, energy reporter for the Desert Sun, who recently wrote a three-part series about how some American billionaires with deep roots in the fossil fuel industry are planning bold clean power initiatives. We talk about the enormous wind farm that conservative tycoon Philip Anschutz hopes to build in Wyoming, discuss the efforts that famed investor Warren Buffett is making to enter California's electricity marketplace, and learn what balancing authorities are and the role they play in our electric grid. Is what's happening in the West just another capitalist scheme to benefit the 1%? Or might these moves actually reduce climate pollution and lower energy bills? I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Sammy Roth. Sammy is an energy reporter for the Desert Sun. Sammy, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hey, Alex. Good to talk to you. Thanks for having me on.
You've written a great summary of the grid issues facing states like California and really the entire West in the Desert Sun recently. Rewiring the West. It's terrific work, and I highly recommend our listeners go to DesertSun.com and check it out. We'll link to it on Sea Change Radio. Why don't you spell out how transmission systems work in this country? They're divided into three main systems, right?
Yeah, so there are basically three sort of independent electrical grids operating in the U.S. There's the Western Interconnect and the Eastern Interconnect, and then Texas, which is ERCOT, which, you know, Texas being very independent-minded has its own system separate from the rest of the country. The interesting thing is that while the Eastern Interconnect is generally pretty well coordinated, like there are different zones within it, but there are these organized regional markets where the different transmission operators work together and share power and whatnot. The Western Interconnect, the whole western half of the country, is fairly balkanized. There are 35 different balancing authorities within the West, and basically each of those balancing authorities is charged with balancing supply and demand on its own system, and they do that mostly independently with not a lot of help from the other balancing systems surrounding them. So what that leads to is, one is a lot of inefficiency where you have, each of these systems has to sort of have its own backup power supply in case of outages and is generally meeting needs with resources, you know, whether that's fossil fuels or renewables from within its own territory. So it's not especially efficient, and it's hard to share renewable energy sort of between different balancing authorities because, sometimes the best wind or the best sunlight is in one place, but because of the institutional and financial barriers that exist, it's not all that easy to send it to another place that's in a different balancing authority. So there's increasingly there's been a push in the West to sort of fix that and bring these systems together and try to find ways for everyone to work together a little bit better, especially with the push for more renewables.
Why don't we focus on CAISO, which oversees 80% of the California grid? Why don't you explain what it does and the role that it's going to play in the rewiring of the West?
Yeah, so CAISO is the California Independent System Operator, and as you said, it does basically about 80% of the grid in California is overseen by CAISO, and so that's Southern California Edison and PG&E and San Diego Gas and Electric and a couple of others. They're all on the CAISO system. And CAISO is important because it is by far the biggest of these balancing authorities in the West. It has sort of the most advanced systems and the biggest staff and the best technology. And so it's kind of in a position where if there's going to be this greater integration to bring these these different systems together in the West, CAISO is sort of naturally positioned to lead that if it wants to, and it does want to. And the sort of what's happening right now is there is this proposal that's been put forward that Jerry Brown, the governor of California, supports to start this integration by bringing this other utility called PacifiCorp into the CAISO system. PacifiCorp is owned by Warren Buffett. It's part of his Berkshire Hathaway empire. It has customers across six different states, Utah, Wyoming, Idaho, Oregon, Washington, and then a little bit of Northern California that's not on the CAISO system.
But PacifiCorp is also a utility that runs two balancing authorities in addition to being a utility. Is that unique, or is that kind of par for the course in California? Are a lot of these balancing authorities also utilities?
Yeah, that's a good question. In general, in the West, yes, like you've got individual utilities that run their own balancing authorities, or in PacifiCorp's case, two balancing authorities. CAISO is sort of unique in the West. CAISO is more like what you have existing on, in a lot of the Eastern market, where you've got different utilities that are part of this, sort of organized regional market overseen by one transmission operator. So that's CAISO, and that's what they do for most of California. But, mostly in the West, you look at this and you've got individual utilities like PacifiCorp that are, running their own balancing areas. So the proposal is for, PacifiCorp, this utility, to bring itself into CAISO and sort of its balancing areas become part of the overall CAISO system.
Before we move on, let's unpack a little bit more what a balancing authority's mandate is. What are they balancing? Supply and demand of energy, I assume.
Yeah, supply and demand of energy. So their job is to sort of be forward-looking and to look ahead into the next day, the next month, the next year, and make sure that there's going to be not just enough electricity on the grid to meet what the demand is going to be, but sort of exactly the right amount. Electricity has to be used basically instantaneously, so there's not a ton of margin for error. They have to make sure there aren't too many plants turned on. They have to make sure they're not enough plants turn on. Their jobs are getting harder and harder with solar and wind coming onto the system, because not only are they intermittent, but you don't always know when they're going to generate and not generate, and because you can't really turn them on or off in the same way that you can like a natural gas-fired power plant, for instance. With solar and wind, you get it set up, and then pretty much it's going to generate when it's going to generate, and your only option is, to say, oh gosh, we can't use all of this energy quick, turn off, which nobody really wants to do, even though that's becoming a problem with solar in California. So you've got CAISO balancing all of those different things, and they're trying to make sure there are no outages, and, they're looking out for issues like fires that could take transmission lines down, and other, earthquake contingencies and other disasters. And so they've got a very complicated job.
When we talk about CAISO, we're only looking at the balancing authority that's covering California, but you had mentioned how the West has its own transmission system. There's the East, the West, and Texas. The West is divided into 35 balancing authorities, you write in the Desert Sun. Is that similar in Texas or in the East, or is it much less heterogeneous?
In practice, it's more balkanized here than it is elsewhere. There are, I think, technically more balancing authorities in the East, but they, again, not an expert here, but the coordination and sort of the working together between them is better there. My understanding is that the West is somewhat unique in the lack of different utilities and balancing authorities working together as sort of an integrated grid.
So let's get back to Warren Buffett's PacifiCorp utility / balancing authority. Why is PacifiCorp so important to rewiring the West?
Sure. So PacifiCorp is important because it is, as of right now, it is the starting point. As I said, CAISO is sort of pretty well positioned to, be this unifying force through the Western grid. And, the first utility balancing authority that came forward and said, hey, we want to be a part of this, was PacifiCorp. It was about 2 years ago. They sort of made this joint announcement with CAISO and said, we're going to study, you know, being the first out-of-state utility to join the California system. And, you know, there's benefits in this for PacifiCorp, one of which is that, you know, it lowers their costs, in theory, if it works out. You know, those kinds of efficiencies that I was talking about earlier, sort of less need for, you know, redundant backup power across different systems, and more easily being able to use, you know, solar and wind and send them back and forth to where the energy is most needed. You know, those are things that are going to lower PacifiCorp's costs and, you know, in theory lead to lower rates for its customers. From a perspective of PacifiCorp's investors, one of the big potential benefits here is that if they join the California system, it will probably be easier for them to build this really big transmission project called Gateway. It's been on their books for a long time. It's, you know, I think they first proposed it 10 years ago, and the idea then was, you know, this sort of series of 10 different transmission lines, it's going to make it easier for us to serve increased demand for electricity. They built a couple of segments, but then what transpired is that they didn't really have the growth of electricity demand that they thought they were going to have. And so now they're kind of looking for a new reason to finish building this project, and having access to the California marketplace, you know, could potentially be a reason where they say, hey, you know, regulators, you should approve the rest of this project now, because we're going to use it to send wind energy to California, and therefore it makes sense. I should also step back and say the reason why PacifiCorp wants this project built so badly is because they would just make a really huge return on investment on it if it happens. It's a $6 billion project. They've got about probably $4.5 billion still to spend based on their original estimates. And that's all money where they are expecting to get about a 10% rate of return on it, and that would go to their investors. So that would be, you know, very big for them if it happened.
You bragging all about the things you can do every time you make a pitch. If you're so smart, how come you ain't rich? You claim to have picked every horse that won, 'cause you know just which is which. Yes, if you so smart, tell me how come you ain't rich. Henry built a Ford and made his pile. Woolworth used his 5 and 10. Rockefeller's wealth came from Standard Oil, and Waterman's came from a pen. You claim it all came from consulting you. Isn't that a brand new switch? If you're so smart, how come you ain't rich?
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Sammy Roth. Sammy's an energy reporter for the Desert Sun. So, Sammy, we were talking about the Western United States being divided into these 35 balancing authorities in terms of its electric grids. And you have a great graphic up here on the Desert Sun that I'm looking at, and it's entitled, Does the West Have Too Many Grids? And as you said, it's quite balkanized. There's a lot of different energy authorities in different states, some which have very different politics and policies. So why don't you first summarize what California is doing in terms of a pretty bold clean energy initiative, and then contrast that with some of the redder states like Utah and Wyoming. And then kind of, if you can, link the fact that these states are actually coordinating. You were talking about these transmission lines. Even though there are state lines, the energy grids are going to be interconnected in the future, correct?
Yeah, they are. Well, it's proposed that they would be, and, you know, it's not 100% that it's going to happen. But so what I would say about the states, so yeah, California wants 50% renewables by 2030, and, you know, Oregon has a similar goal for 2040, and Washington is already like two-thirds, you know, hydropower. Whereas in Utah and Wyoming and Idaho, the other state involved here, there are no, you know, there is no renewable energy mandate. I believe Utah has a voluntary goal of 20% by 2025, but it's certainly not a focus for them because they are, you know, so interested in protecting what they've got, which is fossil fuels. In Wyoming, like 70% of the state's revenue comes from coal and oil and gas, which is kind of a shockingly high high figure. But they're, you know, they're sort of dependent on this stuff. And so they're, you know, worried about shifting to a system where, you know, they're suddenly not sure what's going to drive their economy. The way that plays into this CAISO expansion is, you know, is really interesting because, as you said, there's, you know, there is interest in all of these states in coordinating better and sort of sharing the grid. And, you know, I think policymakers in Utah and Wyoming understand that, you know, hey, California has a, well, especially in Wyoming, they say, hey, California has a sort of a desire for this wind power that we've got in abundance. We sort of see that, you know, this could actually be a really good thing economically for us, you know, creating jobs here and creating investment here. It gets tricky because if you're going to expand CAISO and bring in PacifiCorp, right now CAISO is totally governed by the state of California. The governor appoints the people who are in charge, and the Senate approves them, the state Senate in California. And if CAISO is going to have PacifiCorp in it, you know, the people in charge in Utah and Wyoming, they're not going to be interested in being part of an electric grid that California is in charge of and they don't have any say over. So the sort of big, tricky political negotiation that's happening right now is how these different states, these six states, would sort of share the governance of CAISO if PacifiCorp does join, and who would have the authority to do what. And really the question they're getting hung up over is, you know, how much power does California have? It does have, you know, by far the most electricity demand in this region. It's like 80% of, you know, electricity use across these six states that would be joined is California. And so there's a little bit of a recognition of maybe they should get more of a say over the policy and procurement decisions that are made. But you've got Utah and Wyoming who are kind of afraid of that. And they say, gee, if California has a veto, isn't that like they're still in charge, or they're going to be forcing their renewable energy policies on us? And on the other side of the equation, you have legislators in California who are ultimately going to need to approve this expansion as well. And they're thinking, well, gee, you know, why are we going to give up any control? Or are we going to be putting ourselves in a position where Utah and Wyoming are able to, you know, dictate to us what kind of energy we're getting across the grid? And with Trump's election, I would just add that kind of sort of puts everything into hyperdrive a little bit, where everyone's a little bit more mistrustful, a little bit more suspicious, and also a little bit more uncertain over, you know, would the federal government step into this agreement and sort of rejigger it in one way or another as to help some of the red states.
Yes, it's interesting. You'd think that a Western grid with all these different divisions would be dominated by California, because that's where the population lies. However, when you throw in the Trump wrench to everything, where we have climate change deniers in charge, and you have states like Wyoming, which you mentioned is the largest coal-producing state, and Utah, which is deeply embedded in fossil fuels, these states, even though they have low population centers, have a significant amount of power on a federal level, don't they?
Yeah, I think they do, and because you're already seeing the, you know, the Trump administration is taking its early steps that it wants to roll back the Clean Power Plan and sort of get rid of some of the, you know, not that you know, renewable energy is not going to keep growing, and sort of taking out share from fossil fuel, because that seems like it's pretty inevitable at this point. But you've got these steps that are being taken that are certainly going to embolden some of these states and make it easier for them if they want to push back and to protect their interests.
So let's talk about some of the interests that are coming out of Wyoming, which could ultimately power a portion of California. Why don't you describe the big wind farm project there that Philip Anschutz has been building for the last decade?
Yeah, it's this really interesting example. And I should preface and just say this is a project that is, you know, sort of happening regardless of whether the grids are interconnected. This is one of the few projects that has sort of been able to, you know, get around some of these institutional and financial barriers that exist. And it's largely because they're willing to spend so much money on it. But yeah, it's this Chokecherry and Sierra Madre project being developed by Philip Anschutz, who is one of the richest people in the country. His net worth is like $12 billion. He's a big-time Republican donor. You know, has been in the news recently for giving money in his life to groups that, you know, advocate anti-LGBT positions and sort of climate denial positions.
And he made his money on fossil fuels, right?
Oh, yeah, and he did. He got his start in the oil and gas business, made this huge discovery on this property he owned in Utah, sold it for Mobil for like $500 million. He's definitely not the person you'd expect to be building the biggest wind farm in the country, but...
Kind of like T. Boone Pickens in some ways, right?
A little bit, but I mean, this is certainly bigger than anything T. Boone Pickens has done, because it's bigger than anything anyone has done. I mean, the plan is to go to, you know, he has this ranch in Wyoming. It's huge. It's like 500 square miles. It's the size of Los Angeles. And it's just ridiculously windy. If you look at the maps of, you know, like windiest places in the country, this place is, you know, showing up bright red. They want to build the biggest wind farm in the country there. It would have about 1,000 turbines, 3,000 megawatts of capacity. They've been working on it forever. It first proposed about 10 years ago, and just it's, you know, federal and state and private land, and the permitting has been crazy, and they've had to jump through all of these different, you know, sort of regulatory and legal hoops. They finally seem to be getting, you know, pretty close in terms of having most of the permits they need, you know, for the wind farm itself. The big thing left is that they have to build this 730-mile power line to deliver the electricity most of the way to California. And they still have some steps left to get that approved. But it's the super ambitious project. They're going to end up spending between, like, about $8 billion between the wind farm and the power line just to build it. They've already spent $100 million, even though they don't even have total certainty on the fact that, you know, it's going to happen. So there's a lot to say about this project, and I'm happy to say more, but, you know, in the context of CAISO, it's just, this is the kind of thing that, you know, you can sort of expect to see more of if PacifiCorp joins the California grid, which is these, you know, big renewable energy projects, wind projects, especially outside of California, that are designed to meet the needs of California.
Well, what's so fascinating about Anschutz's project is, I'm curious if you think it is a template for other similar projects, even though it's being built by this very deep-pocketed individual. The other thing is the transmission lines cross from Wyoming all the way across Utah into Las Vegas, around 750 miles. That must be as expensive as and as much red tape as you can imagine. I imagine that the transmission lines are as difficult to build as the wind farm itself.
Yeah, it's also very difficult. I don't know if I could tell you which one is harder, because with the wind farm you have lots of bird issues and studying avian impacts and eagles and bats, and also this particular wind farm, it was you know, they had to deal with sage grouse habitat, which is sort of a whole nother wormhole. But there's been all this controversy the last few years about is the sage grouse endangered, and what can we do to protect it. But yeah, the transmission line definitely will not be easy. They have their federal permits for the federal portions of the land, but that still leaves several hundred miles that would cross over state and private land. And I believe they told me that they've got like 450 private landowners that they have to deal with individually, and four different state governments. And yeah, it's definitely going to be a couple more years before you know, before they can start building that, assuming all goes according to their plan.
And you explain about the Bureau of Land Management's competitive leasing rule, which the Obama administration issued. Would that be rolled back under the Trump administration, or is this something that Anschutz's projects are going to have to work under this rule regardless?
Well, the competitive leasing rule is this thing where, and this was released by the Bureau of Land Management in November, I think just after the election, where rather than solar and wind developers sort of pointing at a spot on the land of on the map of federal land and saying, hey, that's where we want to build, work with us, where instead the BLM, the federal government itself, will identify parcels and say, okay, here's where we think something should be built. You know, developers, if you want to build here, you know, come, we'll have an auction and bid on it. And that's pretty similar to how things have traditionally worked for oil and gas. So Anschutz is, you know, they already have their federal permits, so they're not affected by that aspect of it. The aspect that they are affected by is that the competitive leasing rule, in addition to changing the procedures, also is going to end up raising their costs for how much it costs for them to continue leasing this federal land that they want to build on. So that was something that, you know, they didn't expect, and they'll have to factor into their calculations. In terms of what happens to that rule, you know, it passed late enough in the Obama tenure that I believe it would, I'm fairly sure it would be subject to the Congressional Review Act, where if Congress wanted to, because it was, you know, recently enough they could take a vote and say, hey, we're scrapping this. I haven't heard anything about that. I don't really think it's on anyone's priority lists, because it's not especially controversial in like a fossil fuels versus renewables aspect. You know, whether the Trump administration is going to continue sort of prioritizing and approving new solar and wind projects on federal land, or whether they're going to hold these auctions, you know, that I think is totally unknown, but I don't know that there's a lot of focus on taking that rule away in particular.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Sammy Roth. He's an energy reporter for the Desert Sun. So, Sammy, let's talk about how the revamping of the West's electric grid will affect electricity rates. California has some of the highest in the country. In the short term, will rates go up? What are the expectations, and how are big utilities trying to keep rates low enough so they don't get some kind of a consumer backlash?
So one of the goals of the people who are sort of pushing this grid expansion project, one of the main goals is lower electricity rates. And, you know, if all works as they, you know, they say it should, and as they expect it's going to, that would happen through a few avenues. One would be, as I've sort of touched on, just greater efficiency. If you have, you know, all of these grids working together, it's easier to share the best resources from the best places, and, you know, everyone sort of sees lower costs as a result, and you're building less redundant infrastructure and redundant power plants. For California especially, one of the big potential benefits is the ability to meet its clean energy goals in a cheaper fashion. So if in theory you have this sort of best-in-class wind available in Wyoming or in a place like eastern New Mexico, which is not part of PacifiCorp, but which could, you know, in theory be part of the, you know, the sort of expanded grid eventually. If you can tap into those, you know, really excellent resources, that might be cheaper for you than building out some of the, you know, remaining in-state wind hotspots that haven't been built out yet, because some of the best winds here are sort of already, you know, already taken. They've already got turbines built. So, and in addition to that, you also create new markets to sell solar electricity from California into other states, which potentially makes it sort of easier and more economical to build solar farms here. So you know, in theory, you look at that and you say, okay, if we're going to have to get to 50% renewables either way, it should be cheaper to do it in such a way where we're getting the, you know, the cheapest renewables we can, you know, on the system to serve people in California. The flip side of that is that you've got some critics of this proposal who are worried that what will actually end up happening is that, you know, maybe we can access these, you know, cheap out-of-state winds, but are we going to end up, you know, having to pay more than we expect for, you know, these big expensive power lines to bring us the energy? And, you know, this gets tied into those questions I was discussing about the governance and who's making decisions. Is it California, or is it Utah and Wyoming? And there's sort of this, you know, this fear of, you know, California is going to get stuck paying for all of these power lines that maybe we don't need, or that maybe, you know, they're saying, hey, you know, we're building this line to serve California, but, you know, really there's some other purpose for it, and do we get stuck paying for stuff that we don't need? So there's, you know, pluses and minuses, but in general, the theory is that if it's done right, and if it's done in a way that works for California, this is something that lowers costs, but that's kind of yet to be seen if it happens.
Well, it's a terrific piece, Sammy, and I highly recommend our listeners go and check it out at the Desert Sun. Sammy Roth, energy reporter for the Desert Sun, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
My pleasure. Thank you, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by The Meters and Louis Jordan. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.